serving veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today, 94-year-old Lee Nordgren of Mankato, Minnesota. He spent 3 years on active duty as a Navy fighter pilot during World War II, another 27 years in the reserves, retiring with the rank of commander. You heard him say, "We should have been dead," when describing what he and another pilot did on July 25, 1945, disobeying orders to return to the USS Cowpens and instead pushing through bad weather to attack an Issei-class battleship-slash-carrier in Kure Harbor. That ship would be finished off by other planes a few days later, and I do have a photo of the battleship for you at hometownheroesradio.com, where you can also read Lee's Navy Cross citation signed by Secretary of the Navy John L. Sullivan. For extraordinary heroism as pilot of a fighter plane in Fighting Squadron 50 attached to the USS Cowpens in action against enemy Japanese forces in the Inland Sea of Japan on July 25, 1945, after all other planes of the task force returned to base because of extremely adverse weather conditions, Lieutenant Junior Grade, then Ensign Nordgren, accompanied his section leader through to the target area, then executing a bombing and strafing attack on a battleship-slash-carrier. In the face of accurate anti-aircraft fire, he inflicted serious damage on the hostile vessel. His gallant fighting spirit and unwavering devotion to duty were in keeping with the highest traditions of the United States Naval Service. What did that mean to you to get the Navy Cross, really in order of prominence, second only to the Medal of Honor, to get the Navy Cross and have those words said about you, a 20-year-old kid from Minnesota? What did that mean to you?
Well, it certainly it made a big thing for the Mankato Free Press, because when I came home, all the different service clubs wanted me to talk about my experience. The circumstances were such that I'm pleased that I could be of service after they're spending the money to train me to do it.
In all the years since then, have you ever thought back on that day and wondered, what was I thinking?
No, not really, because that was my job, just to stay with my flight leader, help protect him against other attack, and maybe even find our way back again if it was necessary, because flight leaders can get confused too.
You mentioned speaking at service clubs when you came home from the war, and one of those was the Mankato Kiwanis Club?
Yeah, in fact, I just spoke a couple weeks ago to the Mankato Kiwanis Club and said, I asked if there'd anybody that had heard the first talk. And obviously, 72 years later, they weren't there. In fact, I'm the oldest member of Kiwanis. I was asked by Cease Jones to join in 1950. Really, really am proud of having been a Kiwanian for that long.
And I'm, you know, as I hear that story, I'm wondering, you may be the only one. I wonder if there's anybody else in the country who has spoken to the same service club on two separate occasions 72 years apart. Because they don't have too many speakers in their 20s usually, right?
No, that's right. In fact, 2 weeks ago when I spoke at Monday noon, I purposely put out $20 and put it in the kitty and said, now, I don't think any speaker that I've experienced has ever put money out to speak to Kiwanis, and here's $20. So if you get nothing else but that from my talk, you got $20.
I'm sure they got a whole lot, but I don't know if they got another story of yours from the end of the war, because as you mentioned, you got into combat just months before the war ended, but you did have significant action, obviously, with the Navy Cross, and then you got a taste up close and personal of what some of the American prisoners of war had dealt with. How did that unfold? How did you come to see and witness some of those conditions?
Well, we were sent up from Yokosuka Naval Air Station to precede Governor, or now Commander Stassen, to organize and put the 2,000 prisoners of war on a train to come back to Tokyo. They weren't sure whether the people up there knew the war was over or not, so they sent a couple of ensigns up. So I came up there with my wingman. And by the way, Honshu, that's the main island with Tokyo on it, it's about the size of Minnesota. And flew up to Honshu, and I landed there. And, of course, I don't know any Japanese, and the people there don't know in English, but I took some four-pack cigarettes along. I don't smoke. I've never smoked, but I took them along for conversation. When I put them out, and here's a Japanese fellow, said, "Ah, Chesterfield." So I signaled to have him come over for me, and I'm on the wing of my plane because I had told my wingman to stay in the air until I took my helmet off in case they needed some reminder with firing at a wall or something. Anyway.
Because you weren't sure they knew the war was over?
That's right. If they decided, well, what happened then is that he took off running when I signaled I wanted to go with the Americans in a ride there. And he came back with an officer with a long, long sword and about eight men with rifles. When he took his sword out, I thought, well, if I try and get my pistol out from behind my life preserver, I'll have four or five holes in me before I can get it out anyway. So I might as well just jump down. And I jumped down, and then he offered me the sword as a piece. And I was stunned, but I accepted it from him. And then after a few moments, I gave it back to him. And the people all cheered. That's when we got the ride from the airport, a grass field, by the way, to the prisoner of war camp. And we got to the prisoner of war camp. There were about 2,000 of them there. We were asked to speak to the group. They put a table out in the middle. And the first question they asked me was, "What's going on with baseball?" "I don't know a bleeping thing about baseball." So Bill Sutherland, my wingman, spoke to him about that. But it almost brought tears to my eyes just looking out at those people. And some of them had been captured in the Philippines and were still alive. My second night there, the first night I slept in the cockpit, second night I slept because I had a throat infection. I saw more bugs than I'd ever seen in my life. And I thought, wow, just these guys have lived in this for days, weeks, and months, and years. I was very happy then when the doctor said, "Well, you really shouldn't fly, but if you're going to fly, you better get out there and go." So I flew back down to Yokosuka, and they took me out to the ship. And that's when it was reported that I had received the Navy Cross and had points to go home. Nobody on the ship but my flight leader and a chief petty officer were qualified to go. I mean, it hadn't been that long, you know, 3 months there. But they put me on the USS General Sturgis, and I'd been playing bridge in the ready room waiting for combat deals when got to the point where I thought I was doing fairly well at bridge, except I sat down with the people on the General Sturgis, and I should really have been a lot more aware that I was dealing with three Army people and one Navy man, because the $200 that I had went real fast.
Lesson learned. You're on your way home, and you're probably thinking, well, what's Donna up to, and how long should I wait to marry that girl?
Actually, there was so much puke being thrown up all over that ship, it was such a smelly thing that I didn't really have a thought on what I was going to do after I got home, other than the hope that I could make it home.
Let's go ahead and backtrack a little, too. You told it very quickly and very matter-of-factly, but that scene of you landing and encountering the Japanese, and they come out with a sword and rifles, and you think they're going to kill you when they want to hand you the sword and say, "Yes, we surrender, we know what's going on." What were those few moments like for you when you dropped to the ground and then realized, no, this is the opposite of what I thought it was?
Well, obviously, the transition was a difficult one, and it was a very momentary, because from the time that he had the sword in his hand to the time that he offered it to me was pretty short. It was an unsteadying thing. But I thought, well, I can't smile, but I at least am not going to cry.
But then when you saw those prisoners of war, you probably felt like crying. Can you describe for us the kind of condition that they were in?
Oh, they were so emaciated looking. It's hard to believe. One of the problems that we had, too, is that we were destroying the supplies that were coming in from overseas for the Japanese. And that was the food that was going to feed the Japanese people and the prisoners of war. And you can hardly blame them for wanting to feed the Japanese before they fed the prisoners of war. And that's what it was. They did keep them alive, but it was tragic, really tragic.
Powerful perspective to pick up as a 20-year-old kid. So they give you the Navy Cross. That gives you enough points to come home now as opposed to waiting. How long did you wait to get married?
We were married in June 1946. As a matter of fact, the day that Donna was getting ready for the wedding, that day, my mother said, "Donna, I'm expecting a baby." So I have a sister, Jane, who was 20 years younger than I am. My mother was 45. Donna and I were married for 70 years. She died December 29th, 2016. She was a terrific leader. That sounds funny, but she had good judgment. I'm not a fussy eater. I'm not fussy about a lot of other things, too. So when she made the decisions, it was rare that I had to disagree and have a difficult time. So it went off pretty well.
Well, you've shared a lot of what you went through. I'm sure there are a lot of stories we didn't hear, but there's one thing I don't want to forget to say, and that's thank you. Thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling us a little bit about it. When you think back on it, when you think back of that 20-year-old kid in the cockpit of that Hellcat, what are you most proud of, and what are you most thankful for?
Well, it may be peculiar, but I did have a knack for that particular aircraft, and I had a reputation for being able to handle it quite well. So after the war, when we were in Bemidji on 2 weeks active duty, the guys came back from drinking with the Air Force people who were in Bemidji flying P-51s, flying along the Canadian border, waiting for Russian bombers. That sounds weird, but that's what they were doing. And they'd come down and come roaring across the field at real low levels and look just like fighters. We always came and practiced like we were going to make a carrier landing. Wheels and flaps down, propping low pitch, and like a bunch of old ladies, or old men maybe. We don't need women picking on me. So they came and said, "Lee, we got a deal for you. Tomorrow morning, Sunday morning at 10 o'clock, you're going to take on two P-51s in a dogfight at 2,000 feet. And I said, "That's illegal." They said, "Nah, nobody up here cares." And I thought, well, they figure I'm going to get beat anyway. So, and I beat them, which is, everybody was stunned, because for months after that, at the bar at the Naval Air Station, you'd see guys pointing their finger at me. They were pointing, say, "That's the guy that beat the P-51s.
So it was you alone and one Hellcat against two P-51 Mustangs?
Yeah, but one-on-one.
Oh, you took them on one at a time.
Yeah, one at a time. And I don't know how much background they had. The airplane that I had was kind of beat to hell, but so might have been the ones that they were flying. And so I have no knowledge, other than they got chided for getting beat. And with me, when we landed and reported back, the lieutenant commander that was in charge there said, "Nordgren, you're going back to Minneapolis today, and you're going to lose your wings and your commission." And the chief petty officer that was standing there went over and told the enlisted man who'd been watching the fight. He came back and said, "Commander, if Mr. Nordgren goes back today, the enlisted men are all going too. It's the first chance they've had to be proud of the Navy since they've been here."
Now, there's a story I've never heard before. Well, let's finish with this. Since most of us alive today weren't alive during World War II, we didn't deal with losing buddies, losing friends. Later, you would lose your brother. What do the rest of us need to understand about what you all did and why you did it?
Well, we trusted our leadership to make the better judgment. And very frankly, I am nervous today, not seeming to be concerned about whether we're going to get into World War III or not. It really is unfortunate.
What do you think we can learn from what America was like 70 years ago?
Well, I think that the human nature is similar now. I suspect that the young men today are more oriented around taking care of their country than they probably are in other countries, too. I think we have good patriots here.
And we've been listening to one of them for the last hour. That's Lee Nordgren, 94 years old, of Mankato, Minnesota. Take a look at what he looked like as a 20-year-old Navy pilot and what he looks like now on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page or at hometownheroesradio.com. That's all the time we have today. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you'll join us again next time when we're reminded again through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free.